That's Lee Morgan on trumpet with Cornbread. Jackie McLean on alto sax, Hank Mobley, tenor sax, Herbie Hancock, you might have heard him, on the piano, Larry Ridley on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Monday, June the 24th, and the people of the Republic of South Africa are holding on to a mere glimmer of hope that their beloved leader, Nelson Mandela, will once more somehow rally against a serious challenge to his health. But most family members are saying that he is close, as they say, to making his transition. Mandela has been hospitalized since June 8th with a recurring lung infection. Well, opening statements began today in the trial of George Zimmerman for the second-degree murder of Trayvon Martin. And we've talked about this case before, but while there's a great deal of hype about this case, and it is being built up as an extraordinary case, but actually, when we get down to brass tacks, it is, and it ought to be, a very straightforward case. And so we will present that today by way of one of the most incredible lawyers that I know, and his name is Alton Maddox. Maddox has been at the center of some of the most controversial cases in the African-American community in New York and beyond it over many, many years, and has set many legal precedents in the cases that he has tried. And in that regard, we are leaning on him today as setting a precedent that, believe it or not, is applicable in this case. What is that precedent? In 1986, Alton Maddox was representing the family of three individuals who were in Bensonhurst and were deemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. These were Michael Griffith, his stepfather, Cedric Sandiford, and a cousin, and they were chased out of Bensonhurst, and Michael Griffith, of course, ended up being killed on the highway. Cedric Sandiford and Michael Griffith's cousin were attacked viciously, brutally. The case very early took on a stench in terms of the way it was being handled by the police and investigating authorities and the prosecutor's office. And Maddox's tactic was to withhold cooperation of his client until the governor of the state of New York appointed a special prosecutor in the case. Governor Mario Cuomo at the time decided that he was going to tough it out. And you are speaking to the person who was summoned to the office on a Sunday of the district attorney, John Santucci, who wanted my advice on what it is he should do, because it was his direct responsibility as a district attorney of the borough to prosecute the case. I said, well, who am I to tell you what to do? He said, but I want to know, what would you advise me to do? I said, the folks want a special prosecutor. He ought to get out of the way. And on that very day, in that very meeting, he decided that he was not going to prosecute the case, that he would refer it to the governor for the appointment of a special prosecutor. That case set legal precedents because it was the first time in the country, in the United States, that a special prosecutor was appointed in a hate crime. And Alton joins us now. Thank you, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Utrice.
Oh, very welcome. I got that right, didn't I?
Yeah, except that it was Howard Beach instead of Bensonhurst.
I did
Bensonhurst later.
That's right. Bensonhurst right. Was later. This is Howard Beach. I want to concentrate, Alton, for the edification of the audience, I want to let you know that during the course of the period between the time Trayvon Martin has been killed to even the, up until the time practically of trial, Alton Maddox has been firing off missive after missive, both at the special prosecutor in this case, Angela Corey, and the supervising judge in the circuit in which she is practicing law and holds office as the prosecutor. And he has been pointing out in every single instance, as a self-appointed legal observer, he has been the only private citizen who continuously has been notifying the prosecutor's office of the fact that somebody is watching all of the legal gaffes, all of the legal mistakes, all of the commissions and all of the omissions being made in this case. And this is where we're going to start today. Never mind all the hoopla in the court. There's no big deal. They're making opening statements and whatnot. We'll see. All that's the great grandstanding. I am speaking to the master of opening statements. People used to flock the courtroom to watch Alton Maddox's opening statements. I once wrote an article called High Drama at High Noon. And it was in that case, Alton, that you were defending the Reverend Al Sharpton on 67 counts of federal counts of fraud and related charges. And in the space of half an hour, I think you dispatched about 8 witnesses, and not one of those charges stuck on Mr. Sharpton. But let's start with where you think this case began under the authority, so-called authority, of Angela Corey. This case began to take on a stench.
Well, I think that the audience has to know that when I speak, in terms of history, particularly legal history and legal concerns. And so anyone who just simply starts today watching opening statements is thoroughly misplaced as to how to view this case. You can't proceed without macro-managing the case, not micro-managing, macro. And, that's a term that's used particularly in economics, macroeconomics as opposed to microeconomics. And usually when you hear people talk about judicial trials, they're basically micro-managing. They're talking about, this particular 911 call show that Zimmerman violated this right or et cetera. But that's not really, in my opinion, where you really start. You start, with macro-managing the case, the big picture, not the footnotes. But more importantly, before you get there, I think there are some things that you have to understand about racially motivated cases, which is quite different than simple hubcap prosecution. And one of the things that is important in racially motivated cases is the fact that in order to be effective, you have to ask the local district attorney to give up some powers, because it's a turf war. And when these people run for office in the various counties of New York or the various counties of Florida, they want to be able to exercise all matters that relate to that particular county. So when you start out by, suggesting one way or another that maybe we need to go somewhere else, that's a tremendous loss of power and to that particular prosecutor. And they don't take that lightly. We may take it lightly, but they don't take that lightly. And so that's where it starts. And following up on that, the next concern is whether you get, as a special prosecutor, an elected prosecutor, or somebody who has been unelected. And the reason why that's important is because if you have to deal with elected prosecutors, they also have other matters on their plate, namely police departments. And so if you have to prosecute the police and at the same time ask the police to help you convict other people, somewhere along the line, you know, somebody's going to pull your coattail because they're going to be a snag. So, you know, those are some real realities in just getting started with these racially motivated cases. Now, actually, the concern I had in the case of Florida versus Zimmerman is the fact that actually the person who's prosecuting the case did replace somebody else. But the person that's prosecuting the case is also an elected official. And so this person has a docket of cases, all of whom will depend upon police officers to testify and to lead to convictions. And I don't care which way you cut it, any prosecutor is going to be very much concerned about what do I go back to the police community and say about how I conducted myself in Florida versus Zimmerman. And so there are going to be things that you're going to see, concessions that were made in these trials that may not be visible to the naked eye. And I'll just give you a couple concessions. One is, I don't believe that juries should be sequestered. I don't believe that at the end of the day they should go and be under the custody of the sheriff's department or some other law enforcement agency, and they're there throughout the night and until the next morning they come back. Because over a period of time, those jurors are going to feel some kind of commitment to those police officers. And given the fact that you're not talking about George Zimmerman as a hooded Klansman, he's not presented that way in this case. He's presented as a night, as a neighborhood watch person. And so, you know, that's going to have some real impact because now you're connecting him to the police directly or indirectly because he is in Florida, what we know in New York, as an auxiliary cop, so to speak. And so, you know, there are going to be some preferences that are going to be granted to him. And then the other concessions, you know, in terms of change of venue, whether we're going to leave Sanford, Florida and go somewhere else or not, and just a lot of other things that are never going to be discussed during the course of this trial. And all of a sudden, when people get a verdict that they don't understand, it's because of these little intangibles that have been affecting the trial. Now, I was watching the opening statements this morning, and it wasn't what I saw. It was what I didn't see. And I know that over the years, you've heard me say this, so I'm not breaking new ground here. A trial is won or lost after the opening statement, which means that whatever happened in terms of pretrial publicity, what happened in terms of jury selection, what happened in terms of open statement themselves, have actually concluded the trial. And I've tried hundreds of cases, and I have tested this premise, which has been scientifically, in quotation marks, verified. But it is true from my perspective, is that most trials are won or lost at the end of opening statements. And therefore, the advantage is that to someone like me who subscribes to that theory, I am concluding my case at the same time that the prosecution is getting started to try their case. Because there are a lot of lawyers who actually believe that their cross-examination of witnesses and their direct examination of witnesses and their summations and all of that really have some importance on the trial itself. I have found that it doesn't. Now, given the fact that I believe that myself, other people believe what they want to believe, But this is what I believe, and I've used it and tested it. What I was concerned about this morning was is that the networks abridged the right to a public trial because in their estimation, when certain words were used or certain phrases or clauses were used, they would ink them out, which meant that we never knew what they were. Now, if we were sitting in the courtroom, we would hear everything. But the networks decided to take out certain things that the prosecution said and take out certain things that the defense repeated. So that's an abridgment of the right to a public trial. And I think that in one way or another, that wasn't necessarily that helpful. The other thing that we did see today is that we didn't see what jury selection was really all about. We didn't know how the jurors responded to the questions, how they responded to the attorneys, how it looked as though certain jurors were favorable to a particular side or not. We didn't see any of that. So my theory of this case already have been decided today, I still believe in. I do suggest in some way that if the state of Florida were online, give us the jury selection, then most of us would be more adept at actually concluding how this thing is going to work out. But given the fact that I didn't see any of the jurors being questioned, I am still prepared to say in this trial that George Zimmerman, unfortunately, will be acquitted. And the reason why I say that is because the Constitution actually defines us in all criminal cases as three-fifths of a person. I mean, they just do. And this is something else I have done over the years in terms of predicting juries, is that somehow or another, if there's a real high count, a white jury might convict a white person if the final count is three-fifths of whatever the top count was. But white juries mostly, and this is backed up by history, I mean, we can look at cases like Emmett Till, we can look at cases like the three civil rights workers and all of these cases where there was all kinds of evidence of guilt, and yet white jurors refused to convict, is that my ploy would be two things for George Zimmerman. One, I wouldn't put him on the stand because I think there's enough out there that he can argue without going on the stand, although in most self-defense cases, usually many of them cry out for the defendant to testify, but I wouldn't do it in this case because I think the facts have been embellished to the point where George Zimmerman can take advantage of those facts without taking the stand. And secondly, when the case is over and the judge has a conference before she turns the case over to the jury, in New York, for example, and probably in Florida, the judge will ask you, well, do you want any lesser included? And a lot of times defendants will say, yeah, because it's better to be convicted of manslaughter 2 than murder 2. And so, you know, a lot of times they'll say, yeah, I want the lesser included. But in this particular case, especially when you're dealing with white defendants who are accused of killing black people, if it got to that, the best strategy would be is to say, no, I don't want a lesser included. Send George Zimmerman jail for life or let him go home. And I don't want anything in between. Now, when you put it that way, 99 times out of 100, the jury's going to let George Zimmerman go home.
This is one of the most burning issues, in my estimation, the fact that it concerns the charge itself, the charge of second-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the special prosecutor in this case has, under Florida law, the option to bring charges of second-degree murder and below that. She has the authority unilaterally to do that. And apparently that's what she chose to do. Rather than bring this case before a grand jury with the intent of pursuing a prosecution for murder in the first degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, because you wrote about this, you itemized this as one of your legal missives to the court. Mm-hmm. What was your argument here?
Well, I think one thing that you do say something that's very salient, and given the fact that if a prosecutor intends to stand behind the charges that he or she really desires and will use the full brunt of the office in order to achieve that conviction, the fact of the matter is that this case actually reflects a murder one charge. I mean, there's no question about it. So when you go into court and you half-stepping as opposed to actually presenting what the case really calls for, that in itself begins to affect your own credibility. And so, you know, here's a case where you started out with murder two, and the jury in their heart of hearts, you know, have to know that, look, this man just in a cold-blooded way, not reckless, not reckless disregard or indifference to human life, but just in a cold-blooded way, took the life of somebody else. You know, that's the way that you have to charge, and that's the way that you have to actually argue. I mean, because if you argue if you charge that he did all these things, and then you don't make that kind of argument, that's an inconsistency there. And so I think that you're absolutely correct in observing that there had to be some real concerns as to why this case wasn't given to a grand jury and why the prosecutor in the grand jury didn't really give the signal that this man should be indicted for murder one, and we're going to put the whole resources of Florida behind convicting him.
Because even I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the indictment, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
It is embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
It is an embarrassment. I mean, a high school student could write that stuff. It has no specifics at all.
Mm-hmm.
On a charge this serious,
right,
they write some generalities on a page and a half,
mm-hmm,
and submit that to the court as the state's case against George Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know I'm not a legal expert, but I was amazed that this is what passes for competency at the special prosecutor level. How is it that we are not hearing? I mean, the nuts and bolts of this case seem to be completely out of order. You know, we're supposed to look beyond that now. Well, we should be really glad that the case finally has come to court, and let's deal with what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
But in this regard, I guess you could call me a fundamentalist. I'm interested in why is the foundation of this case so shaky, so filled with holes?
Well, because, you know, obviously, and you indicate this, you know, the way that a prosecutor charged is the way they really see the case. And, you know, here you are charging less than what should be charged, and you're giving Zimmerman some wiggle room. You know, I mean, that's a signal that you're giving to the jury that this is some wiggle room, and the jury, based upon 400 years of American jurisprudence and the slave codes to boot, you know, is going to get the picture that this really is not the way that it has been boasted to be. And, you know, and that's a real serious problem. I mean, you got, you know, whenever you because you see, the thing about it is, look, first of all, if you did murder one, he wouldn't be parading in the front door every day. I mean, so, you know, the mere fact that he can go out to the same restaurants as the jurors go out to and sit there with his parents as they sit there and all of that, it continuously humanizes him. You know, and the only image that they have of Trayvon Martin is the description that he was running around wearing a hoodie at night and nobody knew what he was doing. So, you know, over a period of 2 months, all of this has some bearing on the case. And certainly, if nothing else, if you charge him with murder one, he doesn't get out. He's behind bars. Nobody know what he's like. Nobody know what he might do. And all that still becomes another question mark in terms of how they are going to see this case. Not only for the fact that he may be punished more harshly if he is convicted of a murder one, but also the fact that leads up to the conviction, it takes away all of the trump cards that he may have in trying to wiggle out of this prosecution.
I'm looking at a letter that you sent to the supervising judge, the judge who supervises the court in which State Attorney Angela Corey is practicing. And you called early on in the case, you brought attention to the fact that it should concern the court that George Zimmerman was actually arrested and that he was allowed to leave, arrested. Police must have assumed that it had to do with a homicide that they had just come from the scene of. He vanished, and you called for his rearrest and for the indictment of Zimmerman also for murder and escape. Now, what was the response to that?
Oh, well, I didn't get a response. You know, I mean, I didn't get a response. See, this is another level that we have to look at when we start talking about racially motivated cases. The fact of the matter is that somebody has to inject themselves into the case as a private attorney general. All right, and that's not a fictitious term. That is a term that relates to a person in the legal system who carries out certain responsibilities. So it fits within Black's Law Dictionary and all of that. So it's not just something that I've come up with. But what it says is that a family attorney, somebody who's just simply looking out to make money for the family, is not sufficient. And, you know, so if you got a family attorney and he's there with the family, but mostly his concern is how do I get as much money as I can out of Zimmerman's pocket, the homeowners association's pocket, the state of Florida's pocket, and all these other different pockets, you know, then we are deviating from the route of justice. So, you know, in this particular case, I mean, this is what you have is someone who only has a family attorney. And some people like to call them avalanche chasers. I won't, but, you know, that's a term that is used. Now, the other thing that happens is that in a case of this magnitude where you have millions of blacks who've shown interest in Trayvon Martin all the time, you have to harness that interest and make sure that you don't lose it. And so there are times when Zimmerman lied about certain things, and his wife lied about certain things, and he took off and all of that. Well, it took motions to bring those matters to the attention of the court. I mean, the prosecutor had to bring a motion of some type. Whenever they bring a motion like that, then the legal system, the judge, should hear from the entire black community from Alaska, Hawaii, all the way back to Florida. So, you know, we have a right to file what are called amicus curiae briefs. And in those briefs, you know, we are able to say, well, this is our view of things. This is how we see things. And that's a friend of the court brief. That's nothing unusual, you know. And it shows to the court that these are the interests that we don't think you're taking consideration of, and we think that you need to get serious and do that. And so that kind of operation and strategy was never engaged in here. We have black leaders who never filed any documents that became part of the public record. See, and that's the difference when you were saying that I was writing these people. I was writing these documents because they are now a part of the public record. So 100 years from now, if somebody go back and read about Trayvon Martin, and, you know, they say, well, who were the black leaders? And they'll give a name of 10 or 15 of them. And then they'll look at it in the public record and say, well, I don't see none of their letter to the court in the public record. What was wrong? You know, so what I'm saying is leadership requires more than just standing on a soapbox, mouthing out your grievances to other people in or near the slave quarters. But it required going up to the big house and expressing your concerns there. And this is another problem that we had in George Zimmerman. Everybody stayed away from the big house.
What you've documented it, because I've seen so many of these letters, both to Corey herself and to the supervising court, the supervising judge, that these are matters not just of your observation, but these are matters of law that should be that need to be responded to, and they are in great detail. You cite case law, you cite the basis of your observations, and you argue for things that anybody would say, well, that makes sense. How do you explain that a guy comes into a precinct handcuffed and then leaves of his own volition, and he saunters out, he wasn't running away, he sauntered out. Somebody had to have made a decision, a summary decision, that they don't need to hold this guy in a matter of a homicide. He is not brought before a magistrate. He is not officially charged. He's not held accountable by. He's not even going through the first phase of the process that everybody else would go through. So it draws attention to the fact there must have been collusion or somebody in the DA's office, because that's a prosecutorial decision. Maybe it involves a judge. Maybe it involves the police. But it certainly is troubling that a person would leave a station house, brought in after the police had handcuffed this and brought the suspect in connection with a homicide. The person then disappears, which is to say that whoever made the decision then is to be charged for aiding and abetting an escape. And nothing happens. And it's just going on. Well, we have murder too, and even the special prosecutor herself had a news conference saying, well, we don't know where he is. He's out of contact. He's incommunicado at this time. And we are supposed to now shelve all of the fundamental things that went wrong in this case and that still stink in this case, set those aside and trust that the real deal is happening now that the trial is beginning.
Well, you know, and you raise a very interesting point, and I don't think a lot of people are thinking this through, because if you thought it through, what you said was all fact. It all happened. But it also says that George Zimmerman had friends in law enforcement, and those friends were powerful enough to shield him from any wrath of a good faith prosecution for a long period of time. And even today, he still have those friends. And the concern that we ought to be having today is whether those friends are tainting the legal process by being part of the protectors of the jury.
You made a case to the State Department, to the U.S. Department of Justice. Uh-huh. You made a case that something was going on wrong in Florida, in Sanford, Florida, that warranted federal oversight.
Right.
What was the response? And you detailed all these things. You detailed all the legal things and all the legal reasons why the Justice Department ought to be concerned about this case.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, and I tell people this, and a lot of times lawyers are so apt or so quick to make money. They don't really study the history of the law itself, because studying the history of the law and making money are not the same thing. And so you can be totally unaware of what the history is, and yet you could become a very wealthy lawyer. But when you do study the history of the law, then what you realize is that before 1868, everybody was squarely behind Judge Roger Taney. No Negro has any rights that whites are bound to respect. And that became the law in 1857, officially by the Supreme Court, and eventually many of our revered ancestors went to war because they resented that whole notion that we had no rights, and they understood that we had no chance at all in this country if we were people without rights. And so after 1868, and it shows, if people go and study the Justice Department, which was only established in 1870. So between the time that the Constitution was authored in 1787 and up to 1870, there was no Justice Department at all. And so, you know, you ask yourself, well, what happened to rights then? Well, the rights was fundamental, and they were entrenched. Whites didn't have to have a Justice Department because just on its face, they had natural rights. I mean, so why do you need a Justice Department for somebody who has the natural rights? Because it's where we're understood. Now, when 1870 came about, we were given civil rights. That term had never been existed before, but we were given civil rights. Whites still had natural rights. We were given civil rights. And if you go back and study the Justice Department after 1870 was put mainly in the hands of Confederate soldiers to oversee our rights. So what happened was we had rights on the books. We had the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment. We had the 15th Amendment. We had the Civil Rights Act of 1866. We had the anti-Ku Klux Klan statutes and all of that. But we had no remedies because if you got the Confederacy in the Justice Department now, you have rights on the books, but you have no remedies. And so this has continued up until this particular period of time, and nobody is even challenging that. And so when I wrote this, and you got to remember, you know, the first thing I did when I heard about Trayvon Martin, the first thing I did, even though I didn't have the money to do it, but I went out and bought a little mini Florida law library. So, you know, I was actually citing the law of Florida. I wasn't just popping off at the top of my head. But I had a little mini Florida law library and was able to study that and, you know, and as a result of that, you put pen to paper and to begin to make these arguments. But even up until this particular time, they have all fallen on deaf ears, and they may continue to fall on deaf ears.
I want to draw, Alton, on your experience in this particular kind of case, because you've done many of these cases, but again, we go back to 1986 with the first case. I covered that whole trial, as you know, that whole period, and you were less, let me say, put it this way, I don't want to offend you, but you were less a lawyer and more like a bruiser. I mean, you were ready to fight. You were ready to take on the governor. You were ready to, let's go to the mat on this. My witness is not going to cooperate with anybody until we get a special prosecutor here.
Well,
and
you know what?
That was determined to be a real, extremely bold and rash and kind of uppity of you to take a position like that.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things you treat that happens, and you know, and most people, and certainly most lawyers don't even know this, but there was a presence of black lawyers before the Civil War. Now, there were not that many, but there was a presence of black lawyers in some jurisdictions who were a very vocal and very effective before the Civil War. During Reconstruction, there were other black lawyers who were extremely vocal, who did things way beyond the law books, way beyond the courtroom, in order to secure justice for our people. And unfortunately, most of us don't have those people as role models, you know. And I mean, to cite an example, there was a lawyer in Massachusetts by the name of Robert Morris Sr. And most people should know of him, but nobody does, because if you prize the landmark Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board of Education in 1854, it was Robert Morris Sr. who first planted the seeds for the Brown versus Board of Education by him in Boston before the Civil War, demanding quality schools for black people, and actually sue the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in order for that to happen. Of course, at that particular time, he lost, But that was the first case ever. And Robert Morris Sr. is actually the first, quote, civil rights lawyer, close quote, in this country. But more than that, during that particular period of time, there were the Fugitive Slave Acts that were also in existence. And there was one particularly enslaved African who came to Massachusetts, escaped and came to Massachusetts. And then he, at some point while in Boston, was apprehended by agents of the slave master. And he had to go to the courthouse first because they just didn't send you right back. They took you to court. It became routine, but he had to go to court. And then he had a little kangaroo hearing, you know, that would expedite his going back to Virginia, where he came from. And so Robert Morris Sr. Appeared in court and said, well, I will represent him pro bono and et cetera. And so on the day of the hearing, everybody came into the courthouse and people all outside the courthouse. And Robert Morris Sr. Came across this ruse where attention was distracted from Meshack, the enslaved African. And therefore, while the attention was distracted, there was an escape. And people shutted him out of the courthouse. The marshal was looking somewhere else. And the next thing they know, they were receiving letters from him from Canada, where he couldn't be reached again. So what I'm saying is, you're right when you say that I may have had some elements that were not necessarily normal today, but they were very normal at the time that our ancestors were practicing law, and they just became compromised over a period of time. But if you go back to the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, that was really the period in which all black lawyers should adhere to in terms of the representation of black people.
Well, you started observing the opening statements today, and again, you know, not impressive. I still can't get over what passes or what did pass as an indictment. I mean, it is shameful in the extreme that anybody could get out of law school and write a page and a half to indict a murder suspect. I just don't understand that, and in the worst language.
And you keep hitting on some things that are very mind-boggling that may be missed. And I was watching it today. Do you recall ever seeing either of the lawyers pick up the indictment?
How could you pick up the indictment? It's like as light as a feather.
Well, I'm just saying, but you know, I mean, that's where you start from. I mean, this case started from, well, why are we here? I mean, what did they do? Just seize him and brought him into the courthouse one day? What happened beforehand? Who has charged him? Who's offended by what he has done? I mean, you know, in any case, believe me, the indictment is always an integral part of the opening statement. It's an integral part. I mean, you know, if they don't do anything, I mean, some prosecutors have, in fact, just read the indictment, and later the case was dismissed because the jury said, well, look, you got to put a little meat on the bone now. You just can't read it and leave it at that. But that's how focused lawyers are on the indictment, and yet this is one of the major cases, and everybody talk about everything else. All the legal commentators talk about the jokes and all of that kind of stuff that was going on, but nobody said, well, where was the indictment or the prosecutor's information in this case?
It is a shameful document. I mean,
it must be shameful because it wasn't mentioned today, and that's the problem. That's what I'm saying. You're right. It has to be shameful because nobody mentioned it. And if nobody mentioned it, then why are we here?
I'm looking to see, well, okay, you decided that you're not going to go before a grand jury. You're not going to push unilaterally. You decide that this is going to be the case and I'm going to be controlling everything. And then, okay, but the supposed brilliance is not showing up on paper.
Because we haven't seen the paper. Nobody even mentioned the paper. That's what I'm saying. Well, you know, I mean, you know, regardless of whatever you may want to say in this case, everybody said, well, you know, the prosecutor, he was very strong. He wasn't strong because he didn't mention the accusatory instrument.
I think I'm going to post it on Facebook because people have to see this. It's 1.5 pages.
Right.
That just full of generalities. It actually sounds like, you know, the way I would tell you a story. And then the guy came down, and then that was a sound, and then this guy fell dead, and that's why he's on trial today for second degree murder. That's pretty much how it read.
Well, it's just like going to a birthday party and somebody asks you, well, where's your invitation? Oh, I don't have one. I mean, come on, you can't get it. You know what I mean? I mean, like, why are we here? The indictment or the prosecutor's information is the invitation.
And this is not from some underling, okay? And this was not from an underling. This was from the special prosecutor who wasn't so special. It's not a special indictment at all.
Well, that's the whole point. And that's why I say that you really need this time to really dissect what did happen and what is not happening in this case, you know, and it's frightening. And you're absolutely right to point back to the hidden hand. I mean, nobody knows why we're even here. I mean, so you hit upon the most crucial issue, and that is the accusatory instrument, which there is none. And everybody, and the defense don't want to mention it, and the prosecutor don't want to mention it.
Because I think they both agree. We're gonna make it look like there's something really happening here. And the outcome, probably they're on the same side. That's why I said
I call this on the same side. If nobody mentions it, if nobody mentions the major issue in the case, I mean, you gotta be on the same side. What do we do? You know, if nobody knows what these people are really in charge with. I mean, all this stuff about calling 911, all that stuff, that ain't important to the basic document. That document has to be read. It has to be pushed on the jury that this is why we are really here. Mm-hmm. He violated all of these different laws that exist on the books.
Take my word for it. There is no such information in the indictment.
Well, that's where this whole thing reduces itself, you know, to a worthless sham prosecution, because, as I said, that you start out with reading that. I mean, you don't start out with using profanity and everything else under the sun, you know. And, oh yeah, George Zimmerman is not on trial because he had a bad mouth. And that's what you're bringing this out to me. He's not on trial for that. Or he shouldn't be on trial for that. Because he used salty language.
I tell you, and this, the indictment alone, the instrument alone, is sufficient to actually begin a formal inquiry into the prosecutor's office, because if this is what serves as an indictment, an accusatory instrument coming from a special prosecutor, a page and a half of generalities and silliness on the page. A page and a half is all it's got. And then there are other pages tacked on, two other pages. The whole thing is four pages, two other pages where she signs and verifies it. It's her affidavit. And that's it. But the actual instrument is a page and a half long. And it's just beyond super simplistic. It is embarrassing that anybody calling herself a special prosecutor should produce something like that and then cause the state to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the so-called prosecution of anybody with an expected outcome of justice. That's not going to happen. Not if you base it on that piece of garbage that she submitted as an indictment.
Uh-huh.
So I have to ask, is it possible? What has to happen for some degree of light to be to shine on this office and the conduct of this office, the conduct of the police investigation, the questions that need to be answered about the fundamentals of this case? One, how did George Zimmerman get arrested and unarrested at the same time? Who authorized it? How did that happen? What was the rationale for that? How did he not get, you know, he lied about bail. He raised money and then said he didn't have money for a lawyer. How was he permitted to do that and no additional charge? How was he not a charge for fleeing and escaping the law and evading arrest? How is it that we have a second degree murder charge, because that is the limit to which this special prosecutor can charge without bringing a case to the grand jury? So she conveniently says, well, I'll do it to my max, and my max is second degree murder. That's all it is. Even though she refers in that one very important word in the instrument, profiled, she said he was profiled. In my head, profiled means premeditation, uh-huh. and premeditation means uh-huh. first degree murder.
Absolutely.
How is it that this woman can say, George Zimmerman profiled Trayvon Martin, but the charge is second degree murder?
Absolutely. And you know, and the thing about you, I think that anybody to listen to this program that we've been engaged in a discussion of for nearly an hour now, I think that, you know, it boils down to a federal inquiry, because what Florida is doing is using the court system as a laundromat to clean up George Zimmerman right in front of our eyes. And we should have to, we shouldn't wait until this whole thing ends to start complaining. I mean, there's a difference between somebody who complains early and often and somebody who complains after the fact. And we should not be caught up now in complaining after the fact, because there's enough facts that have already popped up to warrant any of us to be outraged about this whole matter. I mean, and that's really what this boils down to. There's enough on the table right now for people, I don't care who you are, you know, to say, hey, this is a sham prosecution, okay? And somebody needs to pay for it.
Alton, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time today. Of course, it's always instructive talking with you, and we learned so much by listening to the entirely different take on the law that you have, and which, by the way, has served the people of the state of New York and beyond very, very well. You have paid a heavy price and continue to pay a heavy price for your dedication to the community. So you are a rare breed in my eyes. So I thank you for joining me today. And I want to ask you to come back again, because this is a case that I want you, because you set precedence in this particular type of law to be our instructor in this matter of cases of homicide as part of a race-based crime.
Thank you very much for the invitation, and you treat, you know, I will return.
Thank you so much. Well, we've come to the end of our program today. I hope listening to Alton's analysis, and you can see, I mean, I'm not talking out of my head here. There is some legitimacy to these questions. And I always say, don't go for all that hoopla that's going on in the courtroom. That's these people just basically building their personality profiles and the professional profiles so that more people could come and hire them and so forth. The essence here is, what about the rights of Trayvon Martin, and why is it that we allow this spectacular underperformance by somebody whose job it is to see to the highest standards possible? It is very clear that she is not able to rise to that bar, rise to that level, but people need to know that the fundamentals of this case are in disarray. No matter what they say in that courtroom, the fundamentals of this case are completely out of order, and it should concern people who are interested in justice. But instead, people will get mired into the, well, what happened today? Well, this witness testified and that witness testified. It's a circus. It's a charade, because it's all predicated on rotten fundamentals. That's the problem. So I hope that that served some purpose today. We'll join each other again tomorrow. Please join me and pass the word on that PRN.FM is your preferred station because this is where you get some serious info. We'll talk tomorrow. Bye-bye.